Welcome to AZMcast, a peer-reviewed, evidence-based podcast heavily seasoned with expert opinion. For all you new listeners, I'm going to give you a quick tutorial on how to use this podcast to its fullest potential. For you faithful veterans, you can go ahead and skip ahead to the good stuff. As you listen to this podcast, you'll hear contributors give opinions on everything from practice styles to diagnostic evaluations to emergency medicine philosophy. When you hear the bell ding, that means that the opinion is backed by evidence. Check your screen on your device to see the reference paper, and we suggest taking a screenshot for future reading. When you hear the turkey gobble, that's just our opinion, and you can decide whether you want to take it or leave it. Somber music and everything, we're going to talk about a tough subject. This month on AZMcast, we're going to talk about chronic pain in the ED. No, don't shut it off. Don't shut it off. It's going to be good. Now, this is not the reason most of us went into emergency medicine. The word chronic is in the name. We don't like chronic. We like acute, fast-paced, in-and-out medicine that we can diagnose and stabilize and fix. And chronic pain is none of those things. Yet this is a large proportion of the patients that we see in the ED. There's an epidemic of pain that many of us don't know what to do with or how to stop. And I'm with you. I don't know either. But it's a big enough problem that we thought it was worth tackling. And we enlisted the help of Dr. Howard Romer, a local ED doc and chronic pain expert. Dr. Romer has a lot of experience in this area and some good insight into the problem. And admittedly, he doesn't have the answer either. But he does have some great ideas worth considering. So put down the prescription pad and pick up some education on chronic pain in the ED. This month we're joined by someone who's not been on our program before, which we're very excited to have anyone new that isn't sharing the same old opinion over and over. So we have Dr. Howard Romer. Welcome.
Thank you.
So we spoke with him about 6 months ago or so and asked him to come on the program and record with us. And then to my shame, he had to contact me again and said, hey, do you still want to get together? I have some great stuff I'd love to share. And so I hurried to have him on the program as quickly as I could. We're going to be talking about something that probably very few of you ever have to deal with. That's the chronic pain patient. And he has some great insight into this. Would you mind just introducing yourself a bit and telling us about your background and kind of how you came to talk about this topic?
Okay, sure. Okay, so I did my residency here back in the Ice Age with Art Sanders, and as the ice melted, I migrated away from Arizona to Oklahoma, where I ran a regional trauma center for close to 20 years and practiced as an emergency physician for over 30 years. Since that time, I've done several things, including I've been a Joint Commission surveyor. I spent 2 years in Qatar, or Qatar, depending on how you pronounce it, in the Middle East, building women and children's hospital, and working at the busiest emergency department in the country, in the world, that sees 750,000 adult patients a year and 350,000 peds in their separate peds ED. So I could probably do a whole broadcast on that and keep you entertained.
So you have credibility is what you're saying, clearly.
And then, I don't know, it depends who you ask, but I'll take that as a compliment.
Yeah, please do.
And then I came back to Arizona, to Tucson, and I'm now medical director at Sympatico, which you probably see, you do see a lot of our members. We're an integrated health plan, and we cover serious mental illness patients who also have medical problems. I'm the medical director. We also have a psychiatrist who's a behavioral health director. And we're trying to do this innovative project on integrated care for these high-risk people. And in the process of looking at what I wanted to do with this particular job, I noticed that we had a very significant issue with people on high-dose opioids with chronic pain, and they were dying at a very high frequency compared to whatever parameters you want to use for age and comorbidities and social status. So I began digging into it, and I got involved in a project which, as we go along with this broadcast, I will describe, to deal with what the implications are for these chronic pain patients who are on high-dose medications, many of whom, if not all, end up in the ED once in a while or very often.
So this is absolutely an epidemic. It's in the news. It's on social media. It's something that we discuss a lot in passing, on shift, outside of shift. It's been a real problem, and it's something that we are faced with. It's something that we've even been blamed for. And so the landscape of this is quite broad now. This is not something that's just isolated to Tucson or Arizona or even just this side of the country. This is a nationwide problem. And especially an issue in the U.S. So tell me a little more about the chronic pain population and, just kind of where they stand as far as emergency department patients.
Okay. I'm going to start. The residents, by the way, I left out of my background. I started a residency at the University of Oklahoma. I can't remember how many years ago. I think we graduated 7 classes by now. So I was one of the team that put that together and got us approved. One of the things if you know my residents, they know I like to start off with a story. So I'm going to tell you a story. Way back, I'm working in my ED, and patient walks in and complains of chest pain. Now, way back before Emtala, what often happened was the nurse would call the patient's primary care doctor to say, do you want the ER, they use the term ER always, the term EP didn't exist, or ED. Do you want our ER doctor to see your patient, or do you want to come and see your patient? So that was actually standard operating procedure, unless the patient was critical. So this patient comes in with chest pain. They call her primary care doctor. She's a 50-some-year-old lady. And he says, oh, no, he tells the nurse, triage nurse, don't bother your doctors. She's in all the time with all kinds of complaints and chest pain. We never find anything wrong with her. He said, I'm making rounds. I'll come. This is back when private doctors made rounds and they didn't have hospitalists. So the nurse puts her in a room and hooks her up to a monitor. And within a couple of minutes, she goes into V-fib. Call a code. I happen to be a few feet away. I run in and do a chest thump. So again, I'm dating myself. So I do a chest thump.
So many of my residents are just waiting for the day when they can have an excuse to do that. You have made them all very jealous.
Yeah, I have many, many procedures that I transitioned through over decades that nobody does anymore. So she wakes up, she converts, and within a couple of minutes, her primary care doctor comes down, and he looks behind the curtain, and he's wondering what's going on, all this activity, and people are hooking up IV lines, and so I come out of the room and go in the hallway with him, and I tell him what happens, and he goes, Howie, whatever you do, don't tell her, she's just going to blow it out of proportion. And I tell that story because these chronic pain patients are, many of them are walking time bombs, and you may be the last person to see them before they die. So the point of the message is, take, as you should all patients, but take them seriously because it's easy to get lulled on their 20th ED visit for chronic pain. So just, you have to just look for some things. You don't have to do a massive, even an extensive workup, but you need to just be aware of things, which we'll talk about. So getting back to your question, I circled around. I'm going to walk you through sort of the history of how somebody becomes a chronic pain, high opioid user. A typical story is man lifting up heavy box at home, pulls his back, and he's having quite a bit of pain. It's not going away. So he goes to his primary care doctor, or he goes to the ER. That's probably what happens more often. Goes to the ER first. The ER sees him, and I know you guys don't do this anymore, but they do a lumbosacral series, which you guys, I hope, aren't doing for something like that.
No, we do straight to the MRI.
So. as it should be, yeah. So he'll get an X-ray, and then he gets sent home with a prescription for narcotics and maybe a muscle relaxer. And just side note, the only real muscle relaxers are what you use during RSI. Other muscle relaxers are basically tranquilizers. Just my editorial comment.
It's also the only cough suppressant that exists as well.
So they go home, and a little background, opioids are not great drugs for these kinds of pain. And not only are they not great drugs, but there's some pretty good research showing that they cause hyperesthesia after a period of time compared to somebody who's never put on narcotics. It has to do with the body's ability to produce the anti-inflammatory pain chemicals, so you're actually suppressing those. So this patient now is on their... Back then, you didn't have to only give them 7 days of narcotics. Some EDs were giving them a nice 30-day prescription for narcotics. So this patient would have it, and then the narcotics would wear off. They were told bed rest, which is not very good. And within a couple of weeks, this patient's not doing well. They were told to follow up with the primary care doctor. Primary care doctor says, gee, I think I'll put you on a stronger pain medicine since that's not working. And as this goes on, the patient's developing a tolerance to the pain medicine. So they come back and they say, you know, this isn't working. And he says, well, let me add a benzodiazepine. That'll kind of help you relax a little more on top of your muscle relaxer. And that's not working. And then they up the dose of narcotics by adding a nice long-acting opioid like OxyContin. And back in the day, we didn't have anything called MEDDs. We didn't have a Arizona PMP. In fact, in the ED, we had a little rainbow-colored box with people we thought were drug seekers. And it was little index cards.
For those of you that aren't familiar with some of these programs, all but one state, they've all agreed except one that they're going to keep a database of controlled substance prescriptions, which those of you that are residents, if you don't know about this, you should get access to it. If you're a provider and you don't have access to this, this is a whole lot easier than trying to, draw out of a patient when their last meds were, make calls to Walgreens, whatever we used to do. Now it's just all in a database. Incredibly useful, and has really changed at least the way I practice of, when I'm concerned about somebody with dental pain or chronic back pain. Would you mind defining MEDDs for people that aren't familiar?
Okay, it's morphine equivalent daily dose. So they use morphine as your baseline. So if you're on 20 milligrams of morphine a day, your score is 20. If you're on, I have to look it up, and there's easy calculators, but the Arizona PMP does that for you if you look it up on when you pull up a patient's profile. Methadone is multiples of one oxycodone, OxyContin are multiples of one. I think tramadol is a fraction of one, et cetera. So that's how it works. And it's, you add them up. So if somebody's on methadone and a short acting like oxycodone, you add the two together and you get their MEDDs. And there are people out there who are in the, if you look these up, you'll see people who are in the 500 to even over 1,000. Now, you got to wonder, you know, you always wonder if there's diversion going on, somebody's getting those high doses, but we're convinced that some of them really are on those high doses.
Yeah, I've seen people sip the methadone elixir that is potent enough that if I got too close and the patient breathed on me, I'd probably fall over. And it's incredible just how much they can tolerate.
So this person now is on opioid, long-acting, short-acting, long-acting, benzo, muscle relaxer, and then they had a sleep medicine, and now they have their cocktail. And then on top of that, now they're developing all kinds of emotional problems. They may have had a predisposition to them, or now, because they're laid up with this chronic pain and not being able to function well, they become depressed. So either their primary care doctor or their behavioral health doctor starts them on an antidepressant. And this goes on and on. And then they end up on this cocktail of medications, which puts them at risk for a number of things. And we can talk about that more a little later. But they include respiratory depression. They include prolonged QT. And those are probably the bigger ones that we're seeing that we think are causing a lot of these non-intentional overdose opioid-related deaths. And, you know, I've done a lot of research into the population I take care of, and I believe that that is a big issue, prescriptions. And some of the prescriptions do come out of the ED within days. I call them perimortem prescriptions or premortem prescriptions. So hopefully, you know, as we go along with this broadcast, we can give you some pointers.
So tell me a little bit about your typical chronic pain patient. Who is it? Is it males, females, socioeconomic background, race, gender? Or is it pretty much affecting everyone out there?
And that's a good question, because the danger of stereotyping. There was a recent article on Huffington Post, and what it talked about was the cycling of opioid epidemics. It began in the mid-1800s with heroin. And then in Victorian England with laudanum, and doctors had this new tool, or you know, they just start putting lots of people on it, and if you were rich, you were considered you weren't considered an addict, and you know, and that message comes to today. We tend to think of addicts as people who are lower socioeconomic, often, especially in this. People who aren't, and again, I have to separate, although there's an overlap, people who have the technical diagnosis of substance use disorder, which is, you know, which in ER language is opioid addiction or benzo addiction, versus people who have chronic pain who may have that, but they may have gotten it through that pathway I mentioned to you. So they're not really labeled as substance use disorder, which has some effect on what things their insurance covers, like MAT treatment, Suboxone, and other things.
You know, it's interesting because a lot of the population we see in the emergency department tends to be lower socioeconomic, tends to be people that are not as affluent. And yet when you watch the Super Bowl commercials for the opioid-induced constipation and some of these other drugs, it's clearly people that you know, seem to have it all together, for lack of a better word. And it's interesting, or it's important to see that it's both of those. It's not just one or the other. It's really something that doesn't have any respect to race, creed, or gender. So.
Right, and you know, that's a great point, because it really links to the fact that we have a, I'm going to call it a deficiency in our Western medicine and how we deal with a lot of these chronic pain issues. The reimbursement system, you know, pays you to see somebody and give them a prescription. It pays you to do pain procedures like epidural steroids. It doesn't it doesn't reimburse well for a lot of things that if you read, and I refer you to the, there's a recent New England Journal article, and I don't have the reference in front of me, that talks about all the various integrative pain treatments that appear to be effective, and they include cognitive behavior, they include Tai Chi, they include massage, they include acupuncture. A lot of insurances don't really, either they don't cover it or they don't cover it well. And those are the things that obviously you're not going to be ordering out of the ED, but the reason they end up in the ED is they're left with very little other than prescriptions. And when those don't work, these people, whatever socioeconomic status they're on, they kind of reach this, they reach the end of their rope, and they're either out of medications, can't get more because they you know, there's a limit on the number of pills in a prescription. So the tendency often for many of these people is they run out early. When they run out early, they're going to go into withdrawal. So if they go into withdrawal, they're going to go to the ED. EDs vary on how they address that. You know, I'm not sure what you all do.
Depends on who's working.
Yeah, that's right. And because there is no real standard for it, it's not, you know, it's a little better standardized for alcohol and benzos because they're considered dangerous withdrawal symptoms. Opioids don't fall into the same thing because they're generally not going to have a withdrawal episode that's going to kill them. But what will kill them is that they're going to go and use street drugs because they no longer can get their pain dealt with prescription medications. So they'll go to street drugs and they end up often dying.
So when did we start to realize this was a problem? Because there was the pain is the fifth or sixth vital sign campaign, and you know, there was a big push to make sure that pain always gets treated. I know that at the veterans hospitals, there was a huge campaign of none of our veterans should ever be in pain, which sounds great, but clearly leads to problems when we're using medications like opiates. So when did everyone start to wise up that this is actually a problem that we as medicine have caused?
Okay. Yeah, that's, you see, you all in residency have just fallen right into it. And unless you have family members or, you know, a personal experience knowing somebody who's been through it when you were younger, this is really a new phenomenon in the medical world in the U.S. Probably the problem started, I would say, in the 90s when OxyContin began being marketed, and there was a big push by Big Pharm to the prescribers, to the medical practitioners, that this is great stuff. And then somewhere in there, dovetailing it was this Joint Commission National Patient Safety Goal of dealing with pain, which Aaron appropriately called the fifth vital sign. Unfortunately, it got warped by hospital administrators and many others. It wasn't that you had to give them narcotics and make the pain better. You had to address the pain. So in the old days, the nurse would talk to him and say, you know, yeah, this hurts, and you know, you can have this or this, but we really can't give you any more pain medicine, or you may not even get narcotics for this. Well, it totally changed, where everyone was, hospital administrators were saying, we're looking to see that score of 10 goes down to a 4, and you're going to be in trouble if you don't. And then, you know, this was told to me by a number of emergency physicians who said that they had directives from their hospital administration that if they get complaints, because you all get, you know, you get these patient satisfaction, if we get these complaints saying about you, which are often triggered by not getting my medicine refill for narcotics, that's going to affect your position in this emergency department or may affect your group's contract. And that began happening in the late 90s, 2000s. So now the pendulum is swinging the other way, where now it's okay not to be giving that those narcotics.
And my understanding is that there is some evidence that says that patients who exhibit kind of that narcotic dependence, that narcotic-seeking behavior, don't necessarily give you better scores if you give them what they're looking for. So at this point, it's understandable why patients would come to the emergency department when they run out of their prescriptions. It's understandable why they would run out early. It's because they develop a dependence. They don't want to go into withdrawal. So it's understandable, but we have had mixed emotions and mixed reactions to dealing with these patients in the emergency department, and that's led to some regulatory issues because if we don't, as a group, come together and say this is what we feel is best, the regulations often get imposed on us. So there's some new stuff, at least at the Arizona state level, that is starting to come out and even approaching more and more at a federal level. Could you speak on that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, I think it was April 1st. Good day to start it for many reasons. But April 1st, there's the 7-day rule for opiate naive patients, where you cannot give more than 7 days for somebody who's opiate naive. Now that, so these chronic pain patients are not opiate naive, so it doesn't really affect them. There's other initiatives by the state regarding avoiding anyone having MEDDs greater than 90. These are all in the Arizona state guidelines, giving opioids to somebody who's already on benzos. And then, as I mentioned, these other cocktails, which include QT drugs and sedating drugs. So the regulations, what they've led to as far as how it sort of runs downhill, because the primary care doctors are the ones who really have to deal with these 90 MEDDs. And as they're, this is only starting now in Arizona, but we know from other states, there's an advantage to not being at the forefront, because you get to learn from other people's mistakes. The trailblazers are not only the ones who have the best practices, they're also often the ones who have the worst practices. But they don't publish as a worst practice website, you know.
You don't want to be the first one to try something new. You don't want to be the last one to try.
Exactly. So we learned from what happened in states like Florida and Connecticut and Ohio that they did a great job with these government regulations on cutting back prescribing. Average MEDDs went down significantly, but opioid-related deaths went up. Why? Because these people had no place else to turn, and they went to street drugs, which is generally heroin, and mortality rates went up.
We've seen a surprising spike in our adolescent population and college student age in heroin use, at least sometime last year, which some of our toxicologists postulated is probably due to the we're being more stringent and more frugal with giving out opiate medications, and they got to get it somehow. Specifically, you mentioned the two reasons that people will die with pain medications is because of overdose and respiratory arrest, or because of QT prolongation. And the second is definitely not one that we pay attention to as much. At least I can say so for me.
All right, let me talk a little bit about methadone, because one of the problems you'll find is that people who get methadone through it's called a MAT program, medication-assisted treatments for people who are drug addicted, and then they, instead of taking their street drugs or the prescription drugs, they go on methadone, which is distributed by a methadone center. Now, the problem is those drugs do not end up on the Arizona PMP. They're distributed by the center, and they don't enter that drug into the system. It's a real shortcoming. It has to do, I won't get into it, there's some issues related to patient privacy, because the drug addiction is considered a sort of a sacred firewalled condition. So you may not know they're on methadone, but methadone is one of the high-risk drugs. And people who are on, as I mentioned earlier, people who are on high dose, people who are on certain other drugs, which include many of the behavioral health drugs like antipsychotics and antidepressants, so they already come in with some QT drugs. Now, the way most of you are exposed to that is you order something on your electronic record, and I assume your drug interaction list will give you an alert. And what happens, most people get alert fatigue, and some really good studies, especially with QT, and I'll refer you to the main reference for QT in a few minutes. So you say, gee, I mean, I can't give anything. Everything's QT. Well, right now at the Banner hospitals, except here, because you guys aren't on Cerner yet.
Not yet.
I'm not going to do any editorials on EMRs for this broadcast.
We've got about 5 hours worth, I'm sure, we could do on that. We could just take a number and everyone can say their piece.
So at the Banner Hospital, that's where we were, at the Banner Hospitals, in their ICUs, they have a scoring system that has been validated that anytime a new drug or change in dose of a drug occurs, it alerts if there's now a new QT risk. And then you look at the... You're supposed to look at their QT interval to see if it's in that danger zone, the warning zone above 450 and the danger zone above 500. From an ED perspective, you guys are dealing with it on another level. You don't know all the drugs they're on sometimes. You have to go by their med list, and you just go by it. We're working on right now an outpatient scoring system. So the reference I'm talking about is called Credible Meds, and it's actually out of Tucson. And Ray Woosley, who is a former dean here at the university, who's internist cardiologist, I believe. Ray is one of the world experts on QT, and his company contracts the FDA to do QT reviews on any new drugs coming out. I'm working with Ray right now to create an outpatient scoring system that we're going to test out at a couple of the agencies that a lot of my simpatico members go to. And some of the drivers are the drugs, and there's different weights to whether a drug is a definite QT or a possible QT or something. Then there's these metabolic things that increase the potential for QT. So how do you remember all that? Well, he's working on an app that will feed the information and give you a conclusion. And then there's comorbidities. It's believed hypoxia predisposes you to QT, and there's some good studies that show people have sleep apnea. As their oxygen levels go down, if they're at risk for QT, their QT levels may be increasing. So there's comorbidity diseases, and you put all these together and you get a score which would give you a reasonable, we hope, will lead to a reasonable decision-making tree for you when you decide you want to prescribe a fluoroquinolone or a macrolide. So your two big drugs, two of your main antibiotic drugs, are on the QT list. And Zofran. So how many times you order an antibiotic and Zofran? And then, these are important things to know.
Usually I'll give my patients the 2 grams of azithromycin followed by the Zofran because they just took 2 grams of azithromycin. So that's got to do wonders for your QT.
sounds like something worth studying. I don't think I've seen anyone, any work on that particular thing. That's something down the line that we hope will end up helping you at the bedside.
That's great. So I'd like to ask you how the emergency department deals with chronic pain patients, but the methadone patients is kind of a special population. I'm hoping you can shed some light on. How do you address the pain needs of a patient who's on methadone in two situations? One, they come in for a possibly medical complaint, fever, abdominal pain, maybe they have appendicitis, maybe they've got a fracture, they've got something that seems to be medical, versus a patient who comes in and says, I missed my methadone dose, or you suspect that that's actually why they're there. I know that the methadone clinics need to have a special DEA approval in order to dispense methadone for substance abuse, but for chronic pain issues, it's a little different. Can you help us kind of navigate those waters?
So methadone is a class 2. So anyone who's got a DEA for class 2 can prescribe it. It's not considered a... I'm sure any resident who's ordering it without a faculty signature and blood would probably run into some problems, because it is not a drug you generally prescribe out of the ED. But getting to the appropriate, the good question Aaron asked, if you have somebody in the first group, they need to be admitted. Well, they got a serious illness, injury. Obviously, the inpatient service is going to have to deal with their ongoing pain, and they're going to have to hand off that patient on discharge and coordinate with the methadone clinic. From your standpoint, if they're being admitted, that you defer to them, and you certainly would give them some, I would recommend giving them some opioid if they have a significant illness or injury to keep them from withdrawing if that's what's occurring in the ED. For the other group, I think you have to make, I would leave that up to, as a department, to make your own ethical policy saying that we either do or we don't, because I don't think there's a good answer.
Yeah, I think most of us agree it's kind of a slippery slope to start replacing someone's methadone in the ED. And I know that for those of us that are at Banner University South and Main down here in Tucson, if you order methadone, they're going to ask you what the indication is, and they're going to ask you the name of the person at the methadone clinic that you called to verify the dose. I would strongly recommend that you call the methadone clinic and verify a dose rather than take the patient word for the dose. Even though they are generally spot on, they may try to slip a few milligrams, and methadone is not something you want to mess around with.
Right. If you're going to do it, and again, I think that's sort of my suggestion is a departmental policy and how you're going to deal with that. Because if a couple of your guys or ladies are doing it, then you may start getting methadone people saying, hey, Joey was here. You guys called and got him, got something to cover him for a couple of days. The methadone clinics really frown on that, because the responsibility of being in the program is that you're not going to go to the ED for, they don't expect you to be treating them. So
I think this kind of brings us to the big question, which is how do you deal with chronic pain patients in the emergency department? You mentioned, EMTALA, at the beginning of the hour that, we have a federally mandated duty to recognize and treat any emergent conditions, which, you could argue that methadone refills is not necessarily the case. That's not an emergent condition, and opiate withdrawal is not something that is going to be fatal, but it's still, we have altruism because of that. We want to help people, and it's often a difficult conversation. It's the ranges that I've gone through personally have been anywhere from I'm going to spend a half an hour, 45 minutes, and try to talk you through this, or I'm going to spend 3 to 5 seconds and tell you no as I walk out of the room. What is our capacity to deal with this problem of chronic pain in the emergency department?
All right, let me start by saying the ED should not be having to do that role. The ED, obviously, there's no way to stop because of EMTALA, which means they can show up there, you can evaluate them and stabilize. doesn't necessarily imply that you have to treat their, right? And I know that
it doesn't mean you have to treat their pain.
Right. So we've looked at this, and we're doing a project right now, and we're piloting it at Banner South, and we've looked at super users, some of whom are chronic pain patients. And what we're my philosophy is that it should be as easy for a chronic pain patient to get some assistance outside the ED as it is for them to call 911. So we're creating this support system where they have a case manager who has oriented them, and they understand that we will help them deal with their chronic pain issues and their medication issues, and we educate them not to go to the ED. At the same time, we know some will, and part of our program is to make it as easy for the EP to say, I can't write your prescription, follow up with your primary care doctor. Make it as easy to have one of your people call our case manager hotline, and they will intercede. They will either talk to the patient or show up in the ED, which is what we're doing at Banner South with this pilot group, and they will take that patient off your hands. Because I'm a firm believer that you know, the ED has to protect what they do well and what they have the capacity to do, and this is not one of those things, you know, because this is really case management and setting up a treatment plan outside of the ED that doesn't include the ED. So that's, we're working on that now, and hopefully as our pilot proves successful, we will scale up, and a lot of at least the simpatico patients who show up in your ED, you will have that ability to get them out. I'm on all these task force with the state. Everybody wants a piece of this. They're overlapping a lot of what they're saying and doing, and so they're interested in what we're doing because it's kind of novel, and it really is. I view everything from the prism of the emergency department. So if this works, we hope it will see that growing where other insurers will offer that to your hospitals, so you'll have like a hotline and you'll be able to have a reasonable disposition, and less of the people will feel they need to go to the ED.
So while this is this being implemented is going to be great. I mean, it's going to give a lot more resources. That can just be a difficult conversation to have them say, yes, I would like to follow up with someone to help me with my chronic pain issues and my opioid addiction. Because in their mind, it's not my abdominal pain is from my chronic pain, not from my constipation, not from my hypesthesia, not from everything else that's going on with my opiates. Because that conversation is a difficult one. And, you know, to have that conversation even on this podcast would take a lot longer than this podcast is going to be. It can be a while. I've had people range from tears to anger to screaming to, you know, flopping to the ground and refusing to leave. And it's difficult no matter what it is. No one going into medicine wants to be told that they're an awful person and have their, you know, everything about them criticized because of a decision you're trying to make in the best interest of a patient.
Right, because that's the job of the attending, right?
Right, that's what we're supposed to do. That's why we get paid the big bucks. Send your attending in. I'm an attending. Don't do that. But I think that it's important to have that in your mind. Make sure that you honestly believe it first. I've asked you a lot of loaded questions so far, and this is possibly going to be the most loaded, is when a patient is just insisting that they have so much pain, how can you be sure that it's not something else, that you're not going to be on mystery diagnosis on the Discovery Channel? And, you know, these are some of the things that keep people up at night.
Yeah. You know, that also involves a whole other podcast. I just did a conference last week at Banner South on risk management. And I talked about, you know, just some of the basic keys when you evaluate any patient. And, you know, in summary, what I said was, you know, always ask yourself, what's the worst thing this could be? Can I rule it out with a reasonable history? If not, reasonable history and physical, is there any reasonable lab I can do? And if I can't rule it out with any of those things, then what do I need to do next? And, you know, the options are, I call a lifeline, and it's either an attending or a specialist or somebody. I admit them. But, you know, a lot of these people, you have to understand what their baseline is. And good documentation helps baseline. You know, if you see notes from a year ago where everything looks really similar. And, of course, the problem with EMR, everything does look similar.
So, remarkably similar.
So that's why you need to paint a picture that really shows what you're seeing, which is as opposed to all these boxes that make everyone look the same. Anyway, you're right, it's a very tough question. And it transcends, obviously, the chronic pain patient. It's any patient who comes in. Oh, I'll give you a tip. One of the attendings who was here many years ago, in his office, he had a sign for the residents that said, "You don't know what you don't know." But he said there were three things to always think of when somebody comes in with a chronic disease. Is the problem they have just part of their chronic disease, and pain is now considered a chronic disease. Is it related to the treatment of that chronic disease, so side effect, or has nothing to do with the first two? And he said if you keep that little triad in mind, it will serve you well, and that had served me well for my career.
No, that's very good. I think one of the things I had an attending say one time, which I still believe is true, he said, I would rather over-treat 1,000 people than miss one person that truly had pain. I think working in the ER, we have a lot more continuity of care than we'd like to admit, and so you do get to know, like, that rainbow box of flashcards, like you mentioned earlier, of, oh, it's so-and-so, they're back again. If you wait them out, they'll leave on their own. Personally, my approach has been, if you haven't shown me anything initially that you have a pain condition, that this is all chronic, if I think you may have something acute, I'll be happy to treat your pain in the emergency department. But as soon as I've realized it's not, or if I start to get the inclination that this is some kind of opioid-seeking behavior, it stops. And I am always very stingy about sending people home with pain pills. So I'm pretty liberal when I first meet patients. But to go home, you have to have proven that you have something that will actually benefit from a very short course of opiates before you're going to get anything to go home with. That's been one of many practices that I've ebbed and flowed with over the years, but one that served me fairly well, and it has helped me not to stay up at night wondering, did I neglect somebody who actually had something? Did I think that patient was faking and it turned out they had a ruptured ectopic pregnancy, or they had, you know, spinal mets, something awful that really makes you feel terrible. But I think with some of these patients, you're going to feel terrible one way or another.
And the other thing is, so if you just forget the chronic pain patient for saying just pain in general, I assume, you know, your department's working on pain protocols and equivalencies of non-opioids, and, you know, using acetaminophen and non-steroidals combined compared to opioids, there's some evidence about some of the benefits of all that, and the understanding that opioids do create hyperesthesia down the line. So when you put a lot of that together, and you have this person there who's in chronic pain, often you're not dealing with treating the pain, you're treating the withdrawal of pain medicine for a condition that has been partially iatrogenically created, and partly is, you know, lack of our ability to treat. I'm going to say the word fibromyalgia, which
I'm going to bleep it. So,
sometimes you have to tell people, if you're going to show them the air, don't say you have. Say something else, call it something else. And it's sad because, it's an entity, and it, you know, it's gotten this label, and it's like many of the other chronic pain conditions that are real to that person. But I only mention it because what we're treating now with a lot of those people is we're treating the need for them to be on opioids rather than whatever's going on underneath. And again, I think, you know, when I do consulting around the country, one of the things I always tell departments is that's something you as a department need to really try to come to consensus on, because variation in pain treatment is crazy in most departments.
Telling a patient you don't get narcotics is not the same as saying you don't get anything, get out. So I still offer patients adjuncts, other kinds of pain meds, other things. What are some reasonable adjuncts to try to offer a patient if you're not going to be giving them opiates for their chronic pain? What's something that in the emergency department we can have a reasonable discussion with the brief amount of time that we have about, here are some things to do to help?
Well, you know, and it gets into the whole thing is what's your capacity in the ED to tell that story, knowing that you may not have all the tools to communicate that, because we've all been there. You're trying to convince somebody, you realize they're not buying what you're selling. Given all that, you know, I don't know if you guys using ketamine, propofol, or.
We have some people that are doing low-dose ketamine. We have some people that are doing propofol for migraines and having striking results with that. So.
And then as far as, you know, discharge, unless you want to follow in the footsteps of Dr. Wright, who took care of Michael Jackson, obviously you don't. It limits your discharge medication, so you can at least get them comfortable in the ED. But what happens afterwards, which is part of that whole equation. And, you know, most of these people, they're going to tell you right off the bat, you know, yeah, non-steroidals don't do anything for me. And you know, and just in general, the caveat, be careful with acetaminophen because of the hepatotoxicity risk of all the other stuff that they may be taking. So it's really difficult.
You mentioned, we talked about QT prolonging drugs, and one of the drugs used acutely in the emergency department where we work that's had a surprising trend for chronic pain patients has been haloperidol. Clearly, not a good one to give with methadone, along with your Z-Pak and your Cipro. You're almost certainly to treat a case of torsades that way. But that has had kind of an uptrend with the thought that maybe some of this pain is supertentorial in nature. I remind people all the time, it's not a pain medication. It does not act as a pain medication. If anything, it's more of a sedative. But there is some literature I know for droperidol for migraine headaches. And so have you had any experience using some of these medications, these antipsychotics, as pain medications?
Oh, man, it's tricky. I think in a broad sense, I think what you're doing is you're basically blocking, you know, it's just like muscle relaxers aren't relaxing the muscles. They're just, for whatever problem that person's having with their musculoskeletal myofascial problem, you give somebody a good hit of a benzodiazepine, which is what we used to use, which you're talking about, haloperidol. So, when this person's writhing in pain, they come in the ambulance because they can't get off the floor from their exacerbation of their back pain, but they don't have a new injury. They just... I used to tell the residents, you know, let's titrate some benzos, and at least they won't know that they're in so much pain. And I think that is often what we're doing. So, I can't comment on, you know, any studies or anything I've seen using those drugs. I think we're dealing with the two big issues. One is, how do you deal with the person that's right there and get them from point A when you're seeing the point B discharge, and then what happens after point B when they get discharged? So those are two big issues, and I don't have a good answer.
Well, you know, I think the nice thing with where we're at with chronic pain is it's become a very recognized problem. The opiate addiction and dependence has become a well-recognized problem. Governmental agencies have recognized it. Media has recognized it. And our patients are coming in and recognizing it as well. I had a patient a few weeks ago who she came into the ED because she was having back pain, and I talked with her about how I didn't want to give her opiates, and she was on a long-acting morphine and on some short-acting, and she said she didn't want to be on opiates either. Her physician had put her on it. She didn't like the way she felt. She feels like she needs more and more. She's starting to have some of the constipation and some of the other side effects that she didn't like, and she said, I want to get off these, so I was going to stop them. And I warned her, this is something you should do slowly, but I agree with you. I don't think you should be on these either, because you've got a condition that hopefully will get better. You need some other adjuncts. You need things like physical therapy. You need some stretching exercises. You have other things you can do besides opiates, which are likely to drag you down a bit more. So it was the first time I'd had a patient that, when I told her I wasn't going to give her narcotics, actually said, yeah, I don't want that. She wanted something else. She wanted another kind of quick fix, which I told her I couldn't give her. But it's at least enough of a problem that she said she had read that opiates aren't good for you, and actually believed that and wanted to get off. That was very reassuring to me and very encouraging that we're at least headed the right direction of where our patient population is starting to be aware, this isn't the best thing for me. It's not just that my doctor hates me.
Yeah, so you framed that was really good the way you handled that. Now you've gotten her from point A to point B, at least giving her that perspective. And then this patient leaves the ED and tries to get those other things. And that's why I'm saying, we firmly believe that what you need next is that navigator who says, this person's going to hold your hand and help you get these other services and deal with the change in your medications. Because me just telling you that and you leaving the emergency department, the chances of it happening are really low.
It's like trying to navigate your health insurance or so many referrals and so many other things that have been difficult. Having that extra step of someone walking you through there has got to be very helpful. So hopefully this is something that the pilot takes off and continues, and that we've got this the same as we have social workers and case managers in the ED, and we have people that are willing to help, because the problem is real. The problem is has been growing for a long time, and I hope we can kind of abate it. Thank you very much for joining us. We really appreciated getting to talk with you. It's great to see the historical perspective, see kind of how we got to where we are, and then see that we've got hopefully a way out of this as well, in a way that doesn't pit us against our patients, but actually shows that, we all want our patients to feel better. We just can't do it right away in the emergency department. But we hope to have you back on. I want to have you talk more about the Joint Commission as well. That's a really good one, and coming from the other side, it'll be really helpful.
Thank you.
My name is Amol Desai, and I'm a former University of Arizona graduate in 2011. I currently am working in Austin, Texas as an assistant director at a community hospital. We have a level 4 trauma designation, and we see approximately 50,000 patients per year. We work 8.5-hour shifts where we pick up patients for about 7 hours. We see an average of about 20 to 25 patients per shift. We do have mid-level coverage, and they end up taking our low acuity and fast-track patients for the most part. Dr. Howard Romer had a wealth of knowledge, but like most people, we don't have the ability to call crisis lines or anything even remotely like this, so we have to have a way to get these patients out of our emergency room. So here's a typical scenario of what I'm sure you've heard of at some point in your life in the drug-seeking population. Hi, I'm Dr. Desai. Are you Miss, Alata Morfina?
Yeah, and I'm in 20 out of 10 pain. Hold on, I need to take this phone call from my friend.
Okay, whenever you are free, we can continue. So what brings you in today?
I have an exacerbation of my end-stage fibro pain, and I'm on a pain management regimen, and I take Dilaudid orally 4 milligrams 6 times a day, Opana, Xannies only intermittently, MS Cotton, and Percocet for any breakthrough pain. None of this is working, and my pain doctor told me I should come to the ER immediately for 4 milligrams of IV Dilaudid, Benadryl, and Phenagan. Push it as fast as you can. It doesn't work unless it's pushed fast. Oh, and call the PIC nurse, because I'm a really hard stick, and I don't want anyone to try to stick me other than the PIC nurse.
Well, let's start out by figuring out a few things. So how long has this pain actually been going on?
3 years, but the last few months have been the worst. You need to get me the pain meds now. I am dying of pain.
Okay, hold on. Let me call your pain management doctor, and I'll be back to speak with you.
Just make it quick.
So there are a few ways to deal with this type of interaction. I work with doctors that are fresh out of residency and doctors that have been doing this for 25 years, and every single person is different. I try to get their pain management doctor involved as soon as they walk in the doors, but I'm sure, as you know, they work banking hours, and thus if it's after 4:30 p.m., no one returns my phone calls. However, when I do get a hold of them, the pain docs that I've run into have been quite helpful and usually will help direct your care if you can't figure out a plan for them. However, if they don't call back at this point, you got to figure out whether to give these patients narcotics or not. Some doctors go with the path of least resistance and tell them up front they are going to get a one-time shot of whatever narcotics they want, and some will resist and tell them they don't feel comfortable. At the end of the day, patient satisfaction is a huge issue at our hospital. I personally would rather get a negative rating and do what I think is right, which is to not give them narcotics if I think they are drug-seeking. The other school of thought is that we work in a busy environment where your RVU production factors into your paycheck. Some people would suggest that doing the things that gets them out of the ER the quickest so you can see another patient is the most beneficial. The problem with these patients in general is that there is no right answer. You might be fielding patient complaint letters if you don't give them what they want, which takes up more time of your day on your days off. Some solutions that we have come up with is that we also have a pharmaceutical database similar to Arizona, and I end up trying to look them up in the system before I see these patients. These patients can also be really difficult to deal with, and so we started to implement a program a few years ago called the High Alert Program. So basically, when a patient checks in and they are on the High Alert Program, their name appears differently on our tracking system. We place patients in our system in this program if they are frequent flyers, drug abusers, or abusive to staff. We put all of their information over a secure internet site, and the social workers read our issues and come up with a care plan. It is much easier now for our difficult patients to let them know they are on the High Alert Program and that they won't be getting any narcotics unless we find an objective cause of their pain. 99% of the time, the patients are okay with this. Lastly, I have written for 0 Percocet scripts since I graduated from University of Arizona, and since October of 2015, when Vicodin in the state of Texas became a triplicate, I have not written for more than 10 prescriptions in the past 2 years. We just tell the patients now that the government is really regulating these narcotics and we just can't write for them anymore. Again, this works and the patients don't really complain. I'm also with Aaron when it comes to treating pain if it needs to be in the hospital, but I definitely do not discharge patients home with prescriptions. I really don't have much more to offer other than each of you will end up developing your own practice style that you are comfortable with. At the end of the day, if you are uncertain, I think we should give the patients the benefit of the doubt. I really want to thank Aaron for the opportunity to weigh in on this topic and Miss Tucson. If anyone is ever in Austin or wants a job in Austin, please don't hesitate to contact me. Also, if you just want to hear about how private practice differs from academia, I can give you my 2 cents on it. I hope this was helpful and good luck in residency.
Point of the bottom is to show us the height of the fall.